The Knowledgeable Provider podcast is intended primarily to entertain, also to inform, but it is not a substitute for actual medical training and should not be used by anyone to diagnose or treat any medical condition in themselves or others. If you need medical advice, please make an appointment to see your own knowledgeable medical provider. The opinions expressed by me and anyone else who happens to appear on the podcast are solely those of the people expressing them and are not necessarily representative of any other entities. Other than the lunches at the office, I do not receive any sort of compensation from pharmaceutical or medical device companies, and I have no other relevant financial disclosures. Look, this is all for fun, okay? Don't sue me. All right, on with the show. Hello, welcome to Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. If you've been following the Facebook page lately, or my little shorts on YouTube, you know that I've been participating in NEF Madness. This is an annual contest put on by the American Journal of Kidney Diseases. Of course, they do it in March, as in March Madness, like the basketball thing. And I think it's kind of a joke among the community, because probably a lot of people who would do this NEF Madness really don't care about March Madness, and I would definitely fall into that category. So what they do is take topics in nephrology and divide them up into regions. And they have two subjects in each region, which are quote-unquote competing against each other. So they write up all these articles about the different topics, and you pick which of the two you think is going to have the biggest impact on the field of nephrology in the next 5 years. And so then they have this whole thing set up like a bracket, like the March Madness bracket. And so you pick your winners, and then you pick your winners from the next two levels, and finally you narrow it down to one finalist. And so just like a March Madness competition, you submit your bracket, and they have a panel of expert judges who ultimately decide what the winner is going to be and the winner of each contest is going to be. And then they add up your points based on how accurate you are in picking the winners. So it's really a neat thing. I did mine under the name of the podcast, right? Knowledgeable Provider Podcast. So I'm hoping for a little publicity there. And I'm hoping to win, of course. The whole thing's targeted toward physicians. And they do give out prizes for the winners, but I think you have to be a physician to get one of those prizes. They have, you know, top attending and top resident and top medical student, etc. So I don't think I would even be eligible to win any of the prizes, but they have a leaderboard. They have everyone's scores posted publicly. So when they do end up scoring the brackets, you get to see where you fall. And they allow each person to submit two brackets. So I went through and made my picks, read all the information, thought about it, made my educated guesses or decisions. And then they also have an option where you can just select quick picks and it'll just randomly fill in the bracket for you. So my second bracket, I just did that. I just threw a random one in there to see how my thoughts stacked up to just filling it out randomly. And obviously I will report back as soon as I get my score and see how I did compared to all the doctors out there. This is the first year I participated in this contest. I've heard them talk about it on the Curbsiders for several years. And to be honest, I was kind of intimidated because nephrology is like for smart people, right? When you start talking about renal physiology, that can get over my head quickly. I love Dr. Joel Toff, who's on the Curbsiders frequently. They call him their chief of nephrology. I love, love, love how he breaks down everything that he talks about. He actually wrote a great book about electrolytes and renal physiology that makes everything really understandable and simple. And I think he wrote it when he was either a medical student or a resident. And he just gives it away for free. Now you can download it. I definitely keep a copy on the computer at work. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And the really cool thing about NEF Madness is once you do all of the sections, you can get CME credit for it. You get a total of 8 hours of CME, 1 hour for each region. And it probably did take me about an hour to go through each region and read the articles and stuff. So I think that's pretty accurate. But what I'd like to do today on the podcast is just kind of give you summaries of the information from each region, because of course, really what the point of this is to help people learn about these concepts in nephrology or these issues in nephrology. And it turned out I actually really enjoyed doing this, so it'll definitely be an annual thing for me. I think this episode will come out after the contest is over. You have the whole month of March to submit your bracket. So if you want to get in on this next year, just remember to start looking around this March timeframe. So yeah, here's all the information summarized by me. You can find all of this information at ajkdblog.org. Of course, I'll link that in the show notes as well. I'm not going to put individual references for each article that these articles are talking about, but you can find all of that there on the website. All right, so the first region is called Animal House, And the two competitors are Gila Monster versus Mourning Dove. I'll start with the Gila Monster. And the bottom line here is that GLP-1 receptor agonists were derived initially from the venom of the Gila Monster. The Gila Monster is one of only a few venomous lizards that exists in the world. Their venom contains a lot of stuff that is metabolically active in the body. The particular chemical that this article focuses on is called exendin-4, which works by binding to GLP-1 receptors, but it doesn't get broken down really quickly like endogenous GLP-1 does. The function of the endogenous GLP-1 in the body is to increase the number of beta cells, decrease the number of beta cells that die, and make those cells better both at sensing glucose and releasing insulin. So it works to make the pancreas more efficient, and it also causes decreased secretion of glucagon. So of course, all that would work to lower the blood glucose level. Some other effects that it has, of course, one that everybody knows about now is early satiety and weight loss. In the kidney, it works by increasing natriuresis and diuresis. It causes decreased albuminuria. It causes an increased GFR, we think, by dilating the afferent arteriole. And you'd think that might have an adverse effect on glomerular hyperfiltration, right? Just dumping too much on the glomerulus. But actually, it doesn't. It has the opposite effect in diabetes. It works in the adipose tissue to cause decreased inflammation. It has a protective effect for the heart. It decreases the blood pressure. It decreases coagulation a little bit. And in the gut, it acts to decrease the postprandial lipid levels. And so they found this exendin-4 in the Gila Monster venom. And from that, they made synthetic exenatide, which was the first GLP-1 agonist for type 2 diabetes. And of course, we all know how popular the GLP-1 agonists have become. In my little YouTube short, I said, I think these are like the Swiss Army knife of medicine, right? They just do everything. Interestingly, there are some other medicines that are made from venom of other animals. Captopril was actually derived from the venom of the Brazilian arrowhead viper. And eptifibatide, which is an antiplatelet agent, was derived from the venom of the dusky pygmy rattlesnake. How about that? One other cool thing about Gila Monsters that doesn't have anything to do with GLP-1s, as far as I could tell, they have the ability to absorb water from their urinary bladders when they need it. So like they can absorb as much water back from their urinary bladder over a 24 to 48 hour period as they would drink. So like the amount they can absorb in that amount of time would be equal to the amount they would take in. So that helps them maintain their plasma osmolality through months of drought. Very cool. The second category is the mourning dove. One interesting thing about birds is that their blood sugar is way higher than mammals in general. The mourning dove's normal blood sugar range is like 300 to 330 milligrams per deciliter. But in them, it does not cause the sort of complications you would expect in a mammal from hyperglycemia. So possible reasons for this or possible mechanisms. It's thought that maybe their albumin is just resistant to glycation. It may be that they just don't have receptors for advanced glycation products, which are the things that contribute to cellular dysfunction during hyperglycemia in mammals. It seems that birds have a completely different insulin receptor than we do for getting the glucose into the cells. And insulin also seems to function completely differently in the body of a bird. Instead of promoting glucose uptake into the cells, it actually augments renal excretion of glucose. Birds also have this neat trick where they can increase the blood flow to their kidneys, so they're able to maintain renal perfusion even when really severe hemodynamic alterations are going on. They have these little valves that are not present in mammals that they can use to actually control the blood flow to their kidneys. And another thing about bird kidneys is that they have nephrons with and without loops of Henle. So some nephrons have a loop and some don't. And as far as we know, only mammals have loops of Henle in our nephrons, other than birds. Pretty interesting. So these nephrons that have the loops of Henle are the ones that are really good at concentrating urine, right? And so it seems like when birds really need to concentrate their urine, they actually turn off the nephrons that don't have loops and route blood preferentially to the ones that do, so they get more efficient reabsorption. How cool is that? Birds don't have a bladder that just collects urine. They have what's called a cloaca, and that's a little area where the waste from the GI tract and the urine collect together. So it's like the colon and the bladder put together. And sort of like the situation with the Gila Monster being able to reabsorb water from its waste, birds can take that slurry of GI and urinary tract waste and sort of shove it back up into the digestive system or into the GI tract, and they can extract protein, water, and sodium from it. So they also have that capability of reabsorbing extra water from their waste when they need it. Very, very cool stuff. So my pick in this region is the Gila Monster. You know, it's GLP-1s. What else do you need to say? This is like maybe one of the most significant developments in medicine since penicillin and flexible plastic tubing, right? We may look back on this and say, this is where things really changed. I don't like the whole bandwagon situation that it's created. I don't like that patients are going nuts over it. I don't like that they're still marketing it directly to consumers, even though the people who need it can't even get it because of supply issues, and the people who want it can't get it because of insurance coverage. The whole situation's annoying, but clearly it's having an effect on people. And so hopefully we'll see it continue to have a positive effect over the next few years. Maybe we'll even see the rates of kidney failure from diabetes and heart disease go down. In this Animal House region, the selection committee member was Dr. Kelly Heineman from UAB here in Alabama. The writer was Dr. Tiffany Truong from Seattle. And as part of the NEF Madness contest, they also are doing a podcast crawl. So they have all these different episodes of different podcasts that apply to each region. And so if you want to hear more about this region in particular, you'll want to check out the Freely Filtered podcast, episode number 67. The second region is preeclampsia, and the two competitors here are diagnosis and treatment versus risk factors, prevention, and long-term sequelae. So under diagnosis and treatment, they do a little overview of preeclampsia. Preeclampsia is actually the most common glomerular disorder in the world. I didn't know that. I wouldn't have put that together. Of course, it's defined as new onset of hypertension, either with new proteinuria or end organ damage after 20 weeks of gestation. And of course, what pushes you over into eclampsia is if you start having seizures or coma with this. This seems pretty clear cut when you read about it, but actually, like everything else, it's not really clear cut and it can be pretty hard to diagnose. So like if a woman who already has CKD with proteinuria and hypertension then gets pregnant, well, how do you know when she's preeclamptic, right? It would be super helpful if we had some biomarkers where we could actually do a lab test to figure out, does somebody have preeclampsia or not? One thing we know is that a risk factor for preeclampsia is impaired blood flow to the placenta. And so there's a thought that maybe they can find some markers from that tissue being damaged that could be measured. And they have. The FDA actually has approved an assay that looks at the ratio of SFLT1, which is soluble FMS-like tyrosine kinase 1, to PIGF, which is placental growth factor. So you look at the ratio of those two things, and you can actually use that to predict preeclampsia. The SFLT1 is a protein produced by the placenta during pregnancy that has an anti-angiogenic effect, so it stops the development of new blood vessels, and it helps maintain the appropriate depth of the placenta in the uterine wall. So remember, if the placenta grows too far into the uterine wall, then you have what's called placenta accreta. And in women with preeclampsia, you see that SFLT1 level go up. The other factor, the PIGF, is a pro-angiogenic factor, also secreted by the placenta, and it has a role in spiral artery remodeling and also development of a low-resistance placental capillary network. So it affects the blood flow to the placenta directly. Normally, it goes up during the second trimester, peaks between 20 and 32 weeks, and then falls until the baby's born. So with preeclampsia, you see that PIGF concentration go down. So if you have a lower ratio, the magic number is 38, less than or equal to 38, that's a pretty good predictor of who does not have preeclampsia. So it effectively rules out preeclampsia. A higher ratio above 38 may be useful for predicting who does have preeclampsia, but it seems like the data here are less convincing. So good at ruling out preeclampsia, maybe not as good at ruling in preeclampsia. Apparently, it's useful in differentiating between active lupus nephritis and preeclampsia, which sounds useful. And another limitation of this is that it may be not as useful in later stages of CKD. And of course, for preeclampsia, remember that the only way to really treat that is to deliver the baby. The decision to do that is just based on how severe a woman's symptoms are and how far along the pregnancy is. There are some clinical trials going on of medications that might treat preeclampsia by restoring that angiogenic balance. So the ones that they talked about in the article are aimed at decreasing the production of that SFLT1 or depleting the amount of it that's available. The second competitor is risk factors, prevention, and long-term sequelae. Sequelae? If a child is delivered early, preterm, that predisposes that child to developing CKD later on in life. And it seems like the incidence of preeclampsia in wealthy countries is going up over time. As far as risk factors, really the strongest risk factor is having had preeclampsia before with a previous pregnancy. Other things that make a woman considered high risk for preeclampsia, pre-existing chronic hypertension, diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, multifetal gestation, right, so more than one baby, already having CKD, already having lupus, or having antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. Obviously, preventing preeclampsia from happening would be ideal, but it's such a multifactorial problem that all the clinical trials so far have really failed to find a clear answer about how to do that. So far, the most useful thing we found is low-dose aspirin prophylaxis. It seems to reduce the risk of preeclampsia by about 10 to 20% in high-risk patients. We know that preeclampsia is associated with higher platelet turnover and increased levels of platelet-derived thromboxane, which aspirin diminishes the production of, so that may be one reason why aspirin's useful. And also just the anti-inflammatory effect of the aspirin may be beneficial as well. So the recommendation here is to start low-dose aspirin for anyone at high risk at 11 to 13 weeks of gestation and continue that until 36 weeks. The other useful intervention for preeclampsia is blood pressure control. So it seems like if you target 140 over 90 or less, those patients seem to have better outcomes. There may be some benefit to calcium supplementation, pre-pregnancy weight loss, and exercise. Also, there are some studies going on now to see if there's any role for statins, anticoagulation, and or metformin. So my pick in this region is diagnosis and treatment. I love the idea of having a test to diagnose something. One thing that they always say on the curbsiders is just tell us what to do. Just give us a test that tells us what to do. And if they say that, then I feel okay saying that too. The fact that it's already out there on the market and we have it available to me suggests that we might see a lot of improvement in our ability to diagnose this over the next 5 years. Selection committee members for this region are Dr. Jessica Tangren from Massachusetts General and Dr. Michelle Hadunowich from the University of Toronto. Writers are Dr. Gilda Portalatin from Vanderbilt and Dr. Connor Grantham, also from Vanderbilt. If you want to hear a more specific podcast episode about this, you'll want to check out the podcast GN in 10. That's G as in golf, N as in nacho, GN in 10, episode 4. The third region is toxicology. Our two competitors are supportive care and antidotes versus extracorporeal therapies. It seems like nephrology often gets involved in managing poisonings because of the resulting acid-base disorders, electrolyte abnormalities, and acute kidney injury, as well as the need for those extracorporeal therapies sometimes. In practice, the most common poisonings that are treated are methanol, ethylene glycol, acetaminophen, aspirin, metformin, lithium, digoxin, and methotrexate. So here we're under the supportive care and antidote region. Of course, supportive care just means what it always means, right? Supporting the ABCs, neurological function, correcting hypotension, maximizing perfusion, optimizing kidney function, the same thing you would do for anybody who's super sick. And then you just sort of wait on the body to clear the poison on its own. One useful thing is sodium bicarbonate. That can be useful for alkalinizing the urine and getting rid of some poisons. Characteristics that make poisons amenable to being eliminated this way are they're eliminated unchanged by the kidneys. They have a low volume of distribution. So that means that the poison remains in the plasma instead of being distributed to other places around the body. They don't bind much to protein, and they're weak acids. So examples here would be salicylates, herbicides, methotrexate, chlorpropamide, which is a sulfonylurea, brand name diabenese, which has actually been discontinued in the United States, according to Hippocrates. I'd never heard of this medicine before. And phenobarbital. Another method that you sometimes use to get rid of poisons is GI decontamination. That's useful, of course, when the poison is still in the GI tract, so like within a few hours of when it's ingested. Mostly we use activated charcoal for this. Seems like studies really have not demonstrated any clear advantage to using activated charcoal, which is interesting. I guess it just kind of makes sense that if you can adsorb the poison before it makes it into the rest of the body, that's a good thing. But we don't really have a lot of great outcome data to support that, apparently. And of course, an antidote means something that directly counteracts the effect of a poison. So some important questions to ask before we choose an antidote to something, or before we choose to use an antidote to something, are, does the patient have CKD, particularly advanced CKD, because obviously that's going to need different dosing, just like any other medicine, and is that antidote going to be removed by extracorporeal therapy, right? So if we give somebody an antidote and then dialyze it right back out, that's not helpful. So we need to know if the dosing needs to be modified after they end up having extracorporeal therapy, if that's done. Some specific antidotes they talk about in the articles. One is fomepizole. This is an antidote for both methanol and ethylene glycol. It works by inhibiting the alcohol dehydrogenase enzyme, which stops some harmful metabolites from being formed. This might also work for acetaminophen. The mechanisms there are inhibiting the CYP2E1 and maybe also this enzyme that's involved in hepatotoxicity called JUN-N terminal kinase. A second antidote is ethanol. Of course, that is the antidote for other types of toxic alcohols. That also works by inhibiting alcohol dehydrogenase because it has a higher affinity for that enzyme than the other alcohols do. Preferably give that IV. You can also give it via an NG tube. You want to take 500 mLs of a 100 proof alcohol and mix that with 500 mLs of D10W. Of course, giving it through the GI tract like that, it's going to be more difficult to reach therapeutic levels than if you give it IV. Third antidote is N-acetylcysteine. Of course, this is the antidote for acetaminophen. It also works by inhibiting the CYP2E1 and preventing the formation of any harmful metabolites. It also restores the function of glutathione, which acts to facilitate the detoxification of any reactive oxygen species that form and also contributes to repair of the hepatocytes. Its efficacy is limited if you have really severe metabolic acidosis caused by really big overdoses of acetaminophen. Typically, the cutoff for using this is ingestions greater than 150 milligrams per kilogram body weight, or serum concentration of acetaminophen greater than 10 milligrams per liter, and or an ingestion with any evidence of liver injury. This medicine is given IV over a period of 20 to 21 hours. The last specific antidote mentioned is glucarpidase. This is a specific antidote for methotrexate. This is used in conjunction with what's actually considered the primary antidote called leucovorin, also known as folinic acid, not folic acid, folinic acid, which works by restarting the folate cycle within cells that is critical to nucleotide synthesis, which is stopped by methotrexate. So you use these two in combination, and they work to very rapidly convert the extracellular methotrexate into inactive metabolites. It's a single dose given IV, and it works in like 15 minutes to get rid of most of the methotrexate. So really quick there. So if there's an acute kidney injury going on, of course, this is a really great method to use because it just kind of stops the process in its tracks. This glucarpidase apparently is super expensive, so obviously that would limit its use. Our second competitor, extracorporeal therapies. It seems like there's some debate as well as some regional variability in how these extracorporeal therapies are used in poisonings. In general, the indications for this are clear signs of severe toxicity, any situation where the patient's endogenous metabolism or excretory functions are impaired for whatever reason, and we know that dialysis of the toxin is plausible, right? It doesn't make sense to put somebody on dialysis if whatever they're poisoned with doesn't come out with dialysis. So they talk about some different forms of therapy here. The first is hemodialysis. Of course, that's the most readily available and the most rapid form of extracorporeal therapy. This is always the preferred modality. Things that make a poison amenable to removal by dialysis are molecular weight less than 10,000 Daltons, if it's less than 80% bound to protein, if its volume of distribution is less than 1 to 2 liters per kilogram of body weight, if its endogenous clearance is less than 200 milliliters a minute, and if it's water soluble. If you use hemofiltration, you can remove larger poisons up to 50,000 Daltons. The next specific option is continuous kidney replacement, CKRT. The clearance here is less efficient than you get with hemodialysis, but you may be able to actually use it after the patient has hemodialysis to help minimize any rebound effect of the poison moving from the intra to the extracellular space, right? So if you pull all the stuff out of the extracellular space, whatever's left in the cells should transfer back into the extracellular space, and you could potentially pull some more of it out with the CKRT. Next option is hemoperfusion. This is where the blood just goes through a filter, either a charcoal or a resin cartridge, and the poison sticks in the cartridge. This is more versatile. It's not restricted by the molecular weight or the protein binding characteristics of the poison. It does require systemic anticoagulation. There's a risk of hemolysis, and so you have to limit the flow rate to no more than 350 milliliters a minute. Because this is a non-selective medium, right? It's adsorbing the poison, but it's also adsorbing a bunch of other stuff, right? Especially platelets, white blood cells, calcium, glucose, all that stuff gets sucked up by these filters as well. It costs a lot. The availability is not great. You have to change the cartridges out every 2 hours, and there's really no way here to use it to address any kind of electrolyte imbalances or fluid removal like you can with dialysis. The next option is therapeutic plasma exchange. This is where you separate the plasma from the blood cells and then replace it with either albumin or FFP, fresh frozen plasma. And which one you use there just depends on whether the poison more preferentially binds to plasma proteins or albumin. It's super effective for poisons that are very protein bound. It's more effective for things that are really large, so over that 50,000 Dalton threshold, and those that have really low volume of distribution. One session will pull out about 65 to 70% of the poison that's in the intravascular compartment, and there's really not a lot of benefit to doing multiple sessions, so you really just do this once, maybe twice, and that's it. The last option is peritoneal dialysis. There's not really a big role for this in poisoning, obviously it's really slow, right? The max amount of clearance that you get is no more than 20 mLs a minute, so not super useful there. So my pick in this region, supportive care and antidotes. My rationale on that, these are things that are widely available, for the most part are cheap. They don't require any specialized machinery or training or personnel, I mean, other than just regular medical personnel. You can use that in a setting where the extracorporeal therapies may not be available. Really what I said is it can be administered by a dummy like me in a place like this. And obviously supportive care is always the most important thing for keeping patients alive while we're doing whatever more specific things we need to do to fix their problem. So supportive care and antidotes for the win there. Selection committee members for this region are Dr. Diane Colello from Rutgers, Dr. Mark Ganim from Verdun Hospital in Montreal, and Dr. David Goldfarb from NYU. The writer is Dr. Jorge Guyton from Mexico City. If you want to check out a specific podcast episode about this, you'll want to check out EM Crit number 370. Our next region is hyponatremia correction. The two competitors are rapid correction versus slow correction. This is really interesting to me. We've always learned, of course, that sodium should be corrected slowly because of the risk of osmotic demyelination syndrome, and all the guidelines for sodium correction are built around that idea. This osmotic demyelination syndrome was first reported back in the 1950s, caused by osmotic injury and apoptosis of glial cells. But it turns out that several other conditions also cause this without any hyponatremia being involved. Specific conditions are alcohol use disorder, liver disease, hypokalemia, hyperemesis, hyperglycemia, malnutrition, hypophosphatemia, and hypoxia of the central nervous system. All of those things just prevent the astrocytes from adapting to extracellular tonicity that is rising. The symptoms of this and the demyelination itself can happen anywhere from 1 to 14 days after the actual factor that triggers it. Of course, it can progress to quadriparesis and pseudobulbar palsy if the brain and spinal cord get involved. In that case, it's also known as central pontine myelinolysis or extrapontine myelinolysis. You can actually see this on an MRI. They look for a thing called a piglet or trident-shaped lesion at the base of the pons. That can take about 3 weeks to show up, so not super useful in the short term. This is really more of a clinical diagnosis. Last year, this paper by McMillan et al. Came out and cast doubt on the correlation between rapid sodium correction and this osmotic demyelination syndrome. They're calling it a disruptor paper. They studied this huge population of about 23,000 patients that had hyponatremia. About 3,600 of those were corrected rapidly, quote, too rapidly, unquote, which means a rate of greater than 8 millimoles per liter over a 24-hour period. Out of all those patients, only 12 cases of osmotic demyelination syndrome were observed, and only 5 of those were from the group that had rapid correction. They mentioned 2 other studies, one that showed both worse outcomes with slow correction of hyponatremia and no osmotic demyelination syndrome from rapid correction, and then the third study actually showed higher mortality with limiting the rate of sodium correction, and they found that slow correction did not improve the rate of osmotic demyelination syndrome. So it seems like probably malnutrition, hypokalemia, and alcohol use disorder really are probably the most pertinent risk factors for a person to develop the osmotic demyelination syndrome because of having their sodium corrected too fast. So bottom line, it's not great to correct a patient's sodium quickly if they are at risk for developing osmotic demyelination syndrome, and the patients at risk are the ones who are malnourished, have hypokalemia, and or have alcohol use disorder. Doesn't that just sound more like real world reality? I think so. The second competitor is slow correction, and basically in this section, they just sort of point out the limitations or flaws of the McMillan paper. One thing they point out was that the diagnosis of osmotic demyelination syndrome was based on imaging findings. In the original studies that were done on this back decades ago, they actually confirmed the diagnosis with postmortem neuropathological examination. So, of course, you would think that would give you a more firm or more definitive diagnosis. And they also point out that most of the hyponatremia patients in the McMillan study were not imaged at all. So according to this author, if you throw out all the non-imaged cases, the rate of osmotic demyelination syndrome actually increases to 3 times what was reported in the paper. Of course, that's still rare, right? 0.15% versus 0.05%, but still a big increase. 3 times the rate that they reported. They noted that assessment of rapid correction was only done over 2 time intervals, that's 0 to 24 hours and 24 to 48 hours. With some of the time measurements, they actually have 6-hour margins on either side. So this author feels that that increases the risk both for missing and for overdiagnosing, rapid correction. This part didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but I summarized it as best I could. I still don't quite understand what that means. And this person says that the two other studies that were mentioned can kind of be seen as sort of circular reasoning. They say basically what those studies show is that it takes longer to achieve sodium correction if you do it more slowly, and that they don't clearly show a correlation with rapid correction and lower mortality. So maybe the McMillan paper was fantastic, maybe not so fantastic like every study. But the bottom line I took from reading both of these sections is that probably neither rapid correction nor slow correction is the right answer for every single patient, just like everything else in medicine. So my pick here is going to be rapid correction. Anytime we can question something that's been dogma for forever and realize that stuff we thought was not true is actually true or vice versa is fantastic to me. I don't think anyone would be advocating for rapid sodium correction for every single patient. Of course, we have to look at each patient individually, look for risk factors like we talked about earlier. It's interesting to me that, you know, out of one side of our mouth, we go, well, if you hear hoofbeats, you look for horses, not zebras, right? Because common things are common on the diagnosis side. But then on the treatment side, we kind of err the other way, right? We do things a certain way to prevent these complications that are extremely, extremely rare. So it's kind of like two whole different logics that we use there. And I get it, right? First, do no harm. But we also don't want to be doing things a certain way for absolutely no reason. And I like that people look into things like that and question the established practice. So anyway, based on the criteria of this contest, I think that definitely gives us something to think about and work on over the next 5 years. The selection committee member for this section is Dr. Miriam Christ-Crane from the University Hospital of Basel, Switzerland. The writers are Dr. Naman Gupta from VCU, Dr. Alicia Sharma from VCU, and Dr. Graham Gibson from VCU. Applicable podcast episodes for this section are The Intern at Work podcast episodes number 228 and 229. The fifth region is things we do for no reason. Love, love, love this. Again, I'm all for realizing that stuff we've been doing forever really doesn't matter or has the opposite effect that we think. And I love that researchers continue to question what we think we know. So our two competitors here are inpatient use of phosphate binders in acute kidney injury and urine anion gap. Regarding phosphate binders, with acute kidney injury especially, we often see that decreasing GFR leads to elevated serum phosphate levels. And a lot of times nephrologists are consulted in the inpatient setting to start phosphate binders to try to lower that phosphate level. We have evidence for doing this in chronic kidney disease, but is there evidence for doing this in acute kidney injury? The thing about phosphate binders is that they work in the gut, and so they're really most effective when they are in the gut at the same time as phosphate that we have eaten, right, after a meal. And so, of course, if somebody's super sick in the hospital, are they going to be eating regular meals and taking those phosphate binders at that time? Maybe not. Another thing to think about is the relationship of phosphate and calcium. A professor I had one time said that calcium and phosphate are secret lovers. A lot of times you see them kind of doing the opposite things, but really like behind closed doors, they often go together. I've always remembered that. So the kidneys work by getting rid of one and reabsorbing the other. It's kind of the opposite effect there. But in the gut and the bones, phosphate and calcium really more often kind of do the same thing. And regulation of the levels of phosphate and calcium respond to FGF23, which is fibroblast growth factor 23, PTH, parathyroid hormone, and the vitamin D level, which itself responds to the serum phosphate level. So in chronic kidney disease, you have this issue with mineral bone disease developing because the kidneys can't get rid of phosphate as the GFR falls. As that level of phosphate rises, less vitamin D is synthesized, which increases the level of PTH. And all of this causes undesirable bone remodeling. Both phosphate and the FGF23 are known to cause some vascular and cardiac issues in patients with CKD. So we currently have this quality metric where we want to keep the calcium phosphate product, which is literally the calcium level multiplied by the phosphate level, under 55 to prevent any poor outcomes. And so a mainstay of phosphate management in chronic kidney disease is both using the phosphate binders and just limiting the amount of phosphate that's in the diet in the first place. Even in CKD, the evidence for doing that is pretty weak, and there's really no clear target phosphate level to shoot for. With acute kidney injury, you still have the kidneys having trouble getting rid of phosphate, but then there's these other mechanisms that are going on as well. If something's going on that's causing massive cell turnover, so like a tumor lysis syndrome kind of situation, that can cause hyperphosphatemia because of all the intracellular phosphates being released as the cells die. And then if you have that going on along with hyperkalemia, hyperuricemia, hypocalcemia, all of those things can conspire to cause kidney injury, which then further impairs the ability of the kidney to excrete the phosphate. One thing that can happen with extreme acidosis, either from like DKA or lactic acidosis, for instance, is that phosphate can shift out of the cells. So that's another mechanism that can cause elevated phosphate. Again, there's really no clear target for what to shoot for on the phosphate level in these situations. Expert opinion here is to treat it when the phosphate level gets over 10 milligrams per deciliter. They do use phosphate binders to treat this, but there's really no research to show any demonstrated benefit of doing that. And I took that to mean like no research has been done. Not that there's research without convincing results, but that no research has actually been done in these situations. Phosphate binders themselves are not without risk. Some of them have aluminum in them, which can cause toxicity. They have a lot of GI side effects, and it's like a high number of pills that are apparently gigantic and taste bad, so not patient favorites there. Second competitor, urine anion gap. Of course, this is something that's been used for forever to assist in the differential diagnosis of metabolic acidosis. The urine anion gap is the urine cations minus anions, right? So it's the urine sodium plus the urine potassium minus the urine chloride. And that gives you an idea of whether or not the kidney is increasing acid excretion like it ought to when there's acidosis going on. So when there's acidosis, the nephron should reabsorb bicarb and generate new bicarb. The new bicarb that's made is paired with the new acid to turn it into titratable acids and get rid of it. So things like phosphates and creatine or ammonium. So what ends up happening is that hydrogen pairs with ammonia and becomes ammonium, which then gets excreted, and that gets rid of the free hydrogens that way. So it gets rid of the acid like that. And so most of the excreted acid load ends up becoming ammonium. That's how the kidney gets rid of acid for the most part. And of course, we know that under normal conditions, cations and anions should roughly be equal, right? The urine cations and anions should balance each other. Ammonium is a cation, right? It has a positive charge. And so it has to be excreted along with an anion to maintain that neutrality, that homeostasis. It's really hard to measure the level of urine ammonium, so we use the urine chloride as a stand-in for that. So really, it would be better if we could just measure the urine ammonium to know how much acid's being excreted. But because we can't measure it very well, we use the urine anion gap and the urine chloride as surrogates to kind of guess at it or estimate that. If there's renal tubular acidosis for some reason, if there's something else causing the acidosis, right, if there's other cations present, then there's less urine ammonium, therefore less urine chloride, and the urine anion gap goes up, right? It's positive. Some limitations of this urine anion gap: it assumes that there are no additional anions in the urine, right, like you would see with lactate or ketones. If there are other anions around, of course, they might pair with the ammonium instead of the chloride, and so that chloride becomes an inaccurate surrogate for the ammonium if there's anything else around. And the urine anion gap, of course, assumes that there's normal renal function. And in patients who have CKD, the kidney's ability to generate ammonium is impaired, as is resorption of any other anions. So those anions end up in the urine. So really, the urine anion gap is not a great surrogate for urine ammonium, and there's really not a lot of great research that proves that it is. So really what we need is a way to directly measure urine ammonium. There's the bottom line. So my pick in this region is urine anion gap. My rationale there: this is an actionable thing that people can advocate for, that labs can do. Apparently there's already some effort underway to get more labs to check the urine ammonium level. And that's a thing we can actually do in the relatively short term to have a significant impact on patient care. I don't have to mess with phosphate binders personally. I don't work in inpatient setting, and that's something that nephrology would do for CKD patients. But I do love the idea of not having to give a patient something like that, especially based on shaky evidence that it does any good. The selection committee members for this region are Dr. Tony Brew from Harvard, Dr. Farah Dasil from Stony Brook University Hospital in Long Island, New York, and Dr. Lenny Feldman from Johns Hopkins. The writer is Dr. Imran Chaudhry from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. If you want to hear a specific podcast episode about this, you'll want to check out The Curious Clinicians, episode number 85. I listened to that one. It was fantastic. The Curious Clinicians is really a good podcast in general. Highly recommend that one. Our next region is metabolic acidosis. Competitors are metabolic acidosis in CKD in the outpatient setting versus metabolic acidosis in acute kidney injury in the ICU. About 19% of CKD stage 4 patients have metabolic acidosis, which is defined as a serum bicarb less than 22 millimoles per liter. And that is a result of a diminished ability to reabsorb bicarb and create new bicarb in the kidneys. Potential consequences of metabolic acidosis include adverse bone health, decreased muscle mass, progression of CKD and GFR decline, and higher incidence of major adverse cardiac incidents. So research is underway to figure out how to identify metabolic acidosis earlier in the setting of CKD and prevent it from happening or getting worse. So far, the results on that haven't been great, and we don't love the idea of just kind of throwing extra bicarb at people because there are potential adverse effects of doing that. One thing that seems promising is good old dietary modifications, just adding more fruits and vegetables and less animal proteins. And that is helpful to actually generate less acid in the first place. Of course, another big thing that we worry about with CKD patients is hyperkalemia, right? High potassium. And plant-based diets kind of sound scary for CKD patients because they would be consuming a lot of potassium. And so, of course, if a patient does actually have hyperkalemia, they're going to have to adhere to a potassium-restricted diet. So this may not be as applicable in those situations. But the benefits of dietary modification like that include 30% less odds of more kidney damage, improvements in blood pressure, A1C, and proteinuria. So it seems like the benefits probably outweigh the risk as long as the patient doesn't actually have significant hyperkalemia. There is this medicine around called Vivarimer, which works by binding hydrochloric acid in the gut without adding any sodium or potassium. There was a big trial of that that was actually stopped early, apparently due to some kind of administrative reason, not really because of outcomes. But the data they have from that didn't really show much difference in either the bicarb levels in those patients or the rate of CKD progression versus placebo. So the prediction is that we're not going to really see that medicine probably come about in clinical practice. So in the setting of acute kidney injury and ICU, you know, it seems like just giving bicarb in somebody's IV is a very obvious, very simple answer to correct metabolic acidosis. But maybe it's not that simple. There's really not a lot of evidence that giving bicarb to acidotic patients in the ICU does any good at all. Of course, that bicarb contains a lot of sodium, and the bicarb solution is an isotonic solution, so you can potentially cause volume expansion by giving that. If you mix it in a hypertonic solution, it can actually cause hypernatremia. It's also worth remembering that bicarbonaturia drives potassium excretion, so you could potentially raise the sodium or cause volume expansion and cause excess loss of potassium. Also, when you have an increase in serum pH, which would happen after you give the bicarb, that increases calcium binding to albumin and reduces the amount of free ionized calcium that's available. And of course, you wouldn't want to try to use bicarb to correct respiratory acidosis because it actually causes increased PCO2. When they use dialysis for acidosis, really that's just another way to give bicarb without worrying about the volume overload or these other metabolic issues to correct the pH directly. But there's really not a lot of great evidence to show any benefit of doing that either. So my pick in this region is metabolic acidosis in CKD/outpatient world. Why? Well, I work in outpatient world and I can always make a diet recommendation, right? More fruits and vegetables, less animal protein. That's an easy thing to recommend. Maybe not an easy thing for people to implement, but an easy thing for me to recommend. And I love that I can feel a bit more confident doing that without worrying so much about their potassium intake. And in the ICU setting, I'm going to go ahead and guess from my limited ICU experience that people are not going to stop giving that bicarb or using dialysis to correct acidosis unless there's really strong evidence that they should not be doing that. The selection committee member for this region is Dr. Nimrit Goraya from Baylor. Writers are Dr. Taha Mohammed Durde from Washington University in St. Louis and Dr. Marco Thierry, also from Washington University. Some specific podcast episodes to check out about this section are the Curbsiders, episode number 430. I listened to that one. It's excellent, as always, with Curbsiders. And Critical Care Time, episode number 19. Our next region is dual organ transplant. Competitors here are simultaneous liver kidney transplantation, SLK, and simultaneous pancreas kidney transplantation, SPK. So under SLK, simultaneous liver kidney transplant, of course, acute kidney injury is common for people who have cirrhosis, and both AKI and CKD are common in people who get liver transplants. It's pretty hard to figure out what causes acute kidney injury in liver failure, and it's pretty hard to predict whose kidneys are going to recover from acute kidney injury after they get a liver transplant, if they just get a liver. We also don't really have any great tools to help distinguish between hepatorenal syndrome, acute tubular necrosis, and prerenal azotemia as causes of AKI. Commonly, the fractional excretion of sodium is used, but it's really not all that helpful for distinguishing the underlying mechanism either. There are some urinary biomarkers that might be helpful, but they're really not used in standard clinical practice yet. urine microscopy can be helpful, as can renal biopsy, but traditionally you don't want to do any kind of biopsies on cirrhosis patients if you can help it because of the high bleeding risk. In 2017, these criteria for simultaneous liver-kidney transplant came out. The patient has to meet at least one of these, and it has to be confirmed by a transplant nephrologist. They either have to have chronic kidney disease, sustained acute kidney injury, or metabolic disease, meaning kidney failure due to either hyperoxaluria, atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome, familial non-neuropathic systemic amyloid, or methylmalonic aciduria. There is this safety net mechanism where patients whose kidneys do not recover after they have a liver transplant alone can be prioritized for kidney transplant if they were listed for kidney transplant within a year after their liver transplant. So far, we don't have great data to show whether there's a huge benefit to the simultaneous liver-kidney transplant versus liver alone. It does seem like the SLK patients have less rejection because of how the liver affects the immune system. Of course, if you have a patient that has both liver and kidney disease, obviously SLK is the preferred treatment. But of course, it's important to consider an individual patient's risk factors and try to figure out who will tolerate it the best and benefit from it the most. Simultaneous pancreas kidney transplant, SPK. Of course, diabetic kidney disease is the most common cause of kidney failure overall. If a person is insulin dependent and eligible for a kidney transplant, they can also be considered for a pancreas transplant. And that's true whether they are type 1 or type 2 diabetics, which was kind of surprising. I was surprised to learn that. And that can either be done as a simultaneous transplant or a pancreas transplant after they get their kidney transplant. We don't really know if pancreas transplantation has a lot of effect on the microvascular complications of diabetes, so like retinopathy, neuropathy. We think that long-term macrovascular complications may actually be a little better in the SPK patients versus kidney transplant alone. One interesting thing about the way they put a transplanted pancreas in is that the insulin that comes from a transplanted pancreas bypasses the liver. So normally you get that first pass effect with endogenous insulin. So like about 80% of the insulin that is secreted by the native pancreas is actually cleared by the liver. That was just kind of randomly thrown in there. I don't know what it has to do with simultaneous pancreas kidney transplant, but I thought that was super interesting. I didn't know that. So right now it seems like the simultaneous transplant, the SPK, is probably superior to just getting a living donor kidney, both for long-term survival and quality of life in patients with type 1 diabetes. We don't have a lot of data for the type 2 patients yet. It makes sense that there's a little bit of controversy about doing the SPK for type 2 diabetics because, of course, it's only going to fix the insulin deficiency and not the insulin resistance. Apparently, obesity has been associated with worse outcomes for SPK patients, so a little bit of controversy still there. It also seems like the rates of pancreas rejection are lower with the simultaneous transplant versus either pancreas transplant by itself or a pancreas transplant after a kidney transplant. So my pick in this region is the SPK, simultaneous pancreas kidney transplant, really for the simple reason that it's diabetes and kidneys. And I would think that this would affect a lot more people than cirrhosis. So I think it just has potential to help a lot more people and make a bigger change. That's the extent of my complicated thinking there. Selection committee member for this region is Dr. Rosalind Manon from the University of Nebraska. Writers are Dr. Sam Kant from Johns Hopkins and Dr. Manal Alataibi from Al-Qura University in Makkah, Saudi Arabia. If you want to check out a podcast episode about this, you'll want to check out the Nephron segment, episode number 13. Our last region is peritoneal dialysis, and our two competitors here are peritoneal dialysis first versus beyond KT over V. So with peritoneal dialysis first, we have research showing that more patients would probably prefer to start with peritoneal dialysis rather than hemodialysis or kidney transplant. This is really apparently more commonly done in other countries versus the United States. In 2021, in the United States, there was a financial incentive introduced to encourage home dialysis. It's called the ESRD Treatment Choices Payment Model. And so we've seen a little bit more peritoneal dialysis in the United States since that happened. A lot of times what happens is people have to start on dialysis suddenly. They call this an unplanned start. So they're in trouble. The kidneys have kind of failed. It's really too late to try anything else other than hemodialysis. It's really preferable if you can start incremental peritoneal dialysis when you still have some time, right? When you still have some residual kidney function left. And really, even for urgent starts, we do have some data that show a lower rate of bacteremia from peritoneal dialysis as opposed to hemodialysis. you would think just because you're not having to use any kind of central venous catheters for peritoneal dialysis. But other than that, the rates of complications for the two are about the same. Of course, it usually takes a while to get a peritoneal dialysis catheter placed. So if you were wanting to use that for an urgent start, you'd have to be able to get that catheter placed within 48 hours of making the decision to start, which could be a challenge. And also in the past, the recommendation for using that peritoneal dialysis catheter has been to wait for 2 weeks after it's placed to start using it. There is a technique where the catheter can be embedded, so it's placed more like a portacath, and catheters that are placed that way actually can be used immediately. So maybe that's a more preferable procedure to start using. It seems like we also probably should worry a little bit less about things that we've considered as barriers to doing peritoneal dialysis. So having a bunch of prior abdominal surgery, having an ostomy, patients with obesity, patients who have questionable social support or cognitive abilities, that sort of thing. Maybe those things are not as much of a barrier as we have previously thought. In the beyond KT over V section, so KT over V is this number that nephrologists use to quantify the adequacy of dialysis treatment, whether it's hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis. The variables there, K is the dialyzer clearance of urea, T is the dialysis time, and V is the volume of distribution of urea, which is roughly equal to the patient's total body water. So you take the product of the K and the T and you divide it by the V. The initial studies that looked at this showed this very significant mortality benefit by using a specific target of this formula. But since then, when they've studied it, they haven't really been able to reproduce those results. And so some recent guidelines that have come out for peritoneal dialysis really emphasize considering the patient's goals for care and lifestyle rather than just looking at that number as a way to figure out how it's going. There's a great quote from the article about this. It says, quote, "Patients and caregivers rate dialysis solute clearance 52nd out of 56 categories on their list of priorities, suggesting that they find the kinetics of solute transport across the peritoneal membrane somewhat less interesting than the average nephrologist," unquote. I love that. I love it when a little bit of real-world sensibility makes its way into these academic papers. So in other words, you can actually tailor the peritoneal dialysis treatment to match an individual's needs and priorities. So for instance, you could increase the treatment time just to help decrease a person's fatigue and improve the clearance that you get, or you could lower the treatment burden for people who are super frail and have a short life expectancy, even though it would compromise your objective parameters of dialysis performance, like that equation. And in general, there's also just some question about how to measure performance of dialysis and how a patient's doing overall. So using subjective questionnaires versus using the subjective data. That was very surprising to me because, you know, I get a lot of nephrology notes and I pay really close attention to those because they like to bury important things in the middle of those big paragraphs. So I do read those notes pretty closely. And it seems like a lot of nephrology, just looking from the outside, is just toying with those numbers. And so I love knowing that there's more potential for considering subjective factors that the patient may bring to the table in the overall treatment that they're getting as well. So my pick in this region is peritoneal dialysis first. You know, from my perspective in primary care, we very rarely see anyone put on peritoneal dialysis, at least in my practice. We don't actually have a ton of CKD patients in our panel for whatever reason, and we really don't have many on dialysis. But I do have a little bit of experience just from my time on the ambulance, toting people back and forth to dialysis. And you can tell even just from that brief interaction that that's a huge burden on people to go to those hemodialysis centers and sit there for hours and then get dragged back home. And of course, they're always exhausted on the day of treatment. And these people are sick anyway, right? And then I've also picked up patients in emergency situations where they miss their dialysis and now they're really sick. So I think it would be great to get more people on home treatment. So that would kind of make it easier for them to do. And I would think also improving their quality of life. I mean, if you can do the peritoneal dialysis treatment overnight while you sleep, you set it all up in your house, then you're good to go when you wake up. I don't know how it compares as far as just general level of fatigue and exhaustion to the hemodialysis, but I just feel like it's got to be better overall. Selection committee members for this section are Dr. Janice Lee from Emory and Dr. Jeff Pearl from St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. Writer is Dr. Timothy Hopper from Duke. If you want to listen to a podcast episode about this, you're going to want to look for PD Exchange. The episode is called Neph Madness and the Peritoneal Dialysis, Cage Match. It doesn't seem like their episodes are numbered, so I don't know what episode number that is. All right, so we made it to the end. That's my summary of Neph Madness 2024. I hope you got something out of all that. I know I did. At this point, I've spent way more than my 8 hours of CME working on this podcast episode. I think I should apply for some more CME credit, don't you? As soon as I have my results, I will post those either on the blog, on the website, or on Facebook. If you're participating in NEF Madness, I want to know how you're doing also. Reach out on Facebook or by email or over the website. Send me your brackets. Let me know how you do. And good luck to everybody who participated. NEF Madness 2024. All right, that does it for this episode of Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to like, subscribe, or follow on your preferred listening platform. Give us a nice 5-star rating and leave a nice review. If you'd like to help support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/knowledgeableprovider. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients in that order. The book.